And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. In part one, we are reconnecting with Cy Montgomery to talk about an amazing new book about an amazing creature, the octopus. In part two, an archival interview with one of the world's most renowned chefs, Eric Ripert. Here's part one. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about one of the most amazing creatures on Earth, the octopus. And my guest is Cy Montgomery. You might possibly recognize that name because I had the joy of speaking with her not too long ago on the morning show about a truly beautiful book called Of Time and Turtles. In this book, Secrets of the Octopus, Cy Montgomery explores some of the many ways in which octopuses are like no other creature on Earth, creatures that are utterly different from us in nearly every imaginable way, and yet a creature with which it is possible to establish a very close relationship, even friendship. The book comes from the National Geographic Society, and by the way, on Earth Day, there will be a television special that is based on this beautiful book. Earth Day, of course, is coming up on Monday, the 22nd of April. Cy Montgomery has written dozens of books for both adults and children on topics related to animals, science, and conservation. One of her best-known books is called The Soul of an Octopus, and her newest book, once again, is titled Secrets of the Octopus. Cy Montgomery, it's wonderful to be reconnecting with you to talk about this beautiful new book called Secrets of the Octopus. One thing that you say that is so intriguing is this. According to almost every basic classification of animal life, she and I, meaning this particular octopus with which you were interacting, were virtual opposites. Yet I was struck by an unexpected sameness. As you write about the octopus and your relationship with octopuses, that seems to be an abiding theme, that they are so remarkably different from us, and yet a creature with which we can feel an affinity. Help us understand how both of those things can be possible.
Well, that is what fascinates me about octopuses, their sameness and their differences. Their differences couldn't be more obvious because you'd have to go to outer space or science fiction to find an animal more different from us. They have no bones. They have three hearts, blue blood. They have venom like a snake, and they can shoot ink, and they can pour their baggy, boneless bodies through tiny openings. They can change color and shape. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. They don't even, their body plan, instead of like head, torso, limbs, like we go, they basically go torso because the top part isn't their head. It's actually the equivalent of our torso, and then their head. And then their arms are attached to their head, and their mouth is in their armpits. And you look into the eyes of someone like that, and yet you can feel a connection. You can make friends with someone like that. And I did not necessarily expect this to happen when I began to make friends with octopuses. I just wondered, well, what would this be like? But from the very start, the very first octopus I met, a beautiful giant Pacific octopus named Athena, who I met at New England Aquarium in 2011, her eye locked onto my face. I then saw her come out of her lair, turn bright red with excitement, and her arms came boiling up out of the water, suckers first, and she attached her glistening white suckers to my skin. And I could feel that this animal was just as curious about me as I was about her. And later, becoming actual friends with these animals, when they would see me, they would rush from their den. They would want to play. They would want me to stroke them because they enjoy gentle touch as we do. They wanted to hang out and to be chosen by someone like that, someone with whom your last common ancestor was, you know, half a billion years ago when everyone was a tube. That makes you feel like anything is possible.
They are amazing creatures, and of course there is an amazing array of them. You tell us 300 species at least of octopus around the world, and you tell us that as you recount their astonishing ability to shapeshift and camouflage themselves, this is one of the things that is, I'm sure, a serious complication. You tell us that for scientists, I mean, to even know when I'm looking at this particular octopus, what am I really looking at? I mean, which species is this? Because they have this amazing ability to change the shape and texture and color of their appearance in ways that are truly astounding, nearly magical.
Yeah, you're so right. It does make it hard for scientists because they're like looking at, okay, I'm looking at this bright red octopus with prickly skin, and then the next minute there's an octopus over here that's brown with, you know, all kinds of bumps all over its skin and looking really little, and then over here there's another octopus which has stripes, but it could all be the same octopus. It could all be the same individual as well as the same species. But interestingly, one of the things that we report on in Secrets of the Octopus in the book is my good friend, Tatiana Leite, the Brazilian scientist, has found that one way that you can tell the species apart is that each species appears to have one characteristic pattern that it alone can show. But this means that you have to watch that individual, that it only works with live animals. You can't kill the octopus and necessarily tell what species it is. And she's delighted with that, because when she first started doing taxonomy, she was told by her professors that she had to kill all these octopuses, and she didn't want to kill them. She loved them, and they wanted to live just as much as we did. But it was she who noticed that some octopuses that were thought to be, they're called octopus vulgaris, not because they're vulgar, but because it's common octopus, everyone thought that there were all these octopus vulgaris off the shores of Brazil, and the animal that everyone was classifying incorrectly was a new species that now has been named octopus insularis. Hmm. And she was able to find that out by looking at live animals who showed her the secrets of their special pattern that only that species does.
Hmm. Your book devotes an entire chapter just to this matter of the astonishing shape-shifting ability of octopuses. And even for those of us who've read a little bit about this, we're going to learn some truly astonishing examples of that. The second chapter of your book, called Gelatinous Geniuses, talks about the extraordinary intelligence of octopuses. And at one point in this chapter, you pose this intriguing question: how do you measure the mind of a mollusk? And indeed, it is no small matter to try to determine just how intelligent a given creature is, or maybe the nature of that intelligence and the kind of mental life that a given octopus is experiencing. In a nutshell, at least, how do scientists go about examining that intriguing question?
Well, with great difficulty. Because these animals outsmart the researchers all the time. And they do things, too, like crawl out of their tanks when you don't want them to. And they're moody, so sometimes they just don't want to do the tests that you're asking. But what really cool researchers like Alex Schnell have done is they've kind of put themselves into the mind of the octopus, wondering, how can I design an experiment that will motivate them to show what they're really like? If you ask them to do something they're not interested in doing, and then they fail to do it and you conclude they're stupid, you have learned nothing. So she's been able to adapt her laboratory experiments to what the animal really wants to do. And in some cases, she has investigated this sort of thing with cuttlefish who are closely related. She, in fact, came up with this brilliant adaptation of the famous marshmallow test that psychologists have given to small children to see if they can resist temptation. And, you know, octopuses and cuttlefish are not interested in marshmallows. You can't measure their later performance on SATs as people did who were conducting the marshmallow test on humans. But they adapted it with high-value treats that the octopus is interested in, like they'd much rather have live prey than frozen prey. And they found that with cuttlefish, who were cooperating much better with Alex than her octopuses were, that they are capable of saying, you know what, I'm going to wait and not take the frozen shrimp that's sitting in front of me, because I know that in a few minutes you're going to offer me a delicious live shrimp. I am able, even though I'm a cuttlefish, to put that off, which entails thinking of the future and also requires self-control.
And those are mental processes those are mental processes that we just don't associate with many animals at all, and particularly something like the octopus. And yet we are confronted
by... Right, they're related to clams and snails. And we don't think of clams and snails as all that smart. Clams, in fact, have no brain. So this is amazing to see thought processes so like our own in an animal so different from us.
Absolutely. You have a deep personal connection with several octopuses that you describe in great detail. And I remember in talking about one of them, you talk about, I met Octavia in blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, most of the time we wouldn't necessarily frame it that way. We wouldn't say, I met this woodpecker. We would just, the first time I saw this woodpecker, but you felt like you met Octavia. That suggests, among other things, that from the very moment, even before a deep connection had been established, that you were approaching this octopus and others with a certain expectation and appreciation for who they were. Tell us more about the nature of these relationships that you experienced and write about so beautifully in your book.
Well, these animals are individuals just like we are. And increasingly, scientists are realizing that we have to understand that each one has a different personality, even if they are not a person in the way we understand person to mean human being. In zoos and aquaria that keep octopuses, the keepers have understood this for ages, and they often reflect the individuality of the octopus in the animal's name. For instance, there was one at the Seattle Aquarium they called Emily Dickinson because she was so shy she never came out from under the filter, and they finally just let her go in the sea. There was another one that they called Leisure Suit Larry, and that was because his hands were all over you. It was just like, you know, that creepy guy you'd meet in the 1970s wearing a leisure suit. You'd pull one arm off and two other arms would go on. There was another they called Lucretia McEvil because she liked to dismantle everything in her tank, including, you know, the water pump and the filter, which would make a big mess every day. So keepers have understood this for ages. Scientists are now doing personality studies on octopuses. And I actually went to Moorea with Jennifer Mather and a team of wonderful scientists doing a personality study of wild octopuses in an effort to understand how personality affects how many different kinds of prey items that they will eat, how large an area they might travel in. You can even see if, you know, an outgoing octopus, do they have more mates? Do they get better food? Or are they the ones that get eaten? And all of these things are really interesting to study because it shows that who an octopus is just as important to, you know, the outcome of that animal's life as who we are is to our lives.
Hmm. At one point you write, we need to shed our arrogance. We need to open ourselves to awe. Explain why those words are here and why you think the octopus is exactly the kind of creature in which we might learn to shed our arrogance.
Well, an octopus could ask of us, how smart are you really? I'm going to do a test. I'm going to see how many different colors your severed arm can turn in a fifth of a second. Because their severed arms can turn color faster than you can blink an eye. They might conclude we were really, really dumb. So when we fail to open ourselves to the possibilities of other creatures, this blinds us to all kinds of glorious new questions we can ask. And it also cuts us off from the rest of animate creation. If we assume only humans think, feel, and know, we're never going to understand the other lives around us. If you believe in evolution, which I do, I accept the evidence for evolution, the scientific evidence, we are literally all related. We share 90% of our genetic material with all other mammals, but we share 40% of our genetic material with a banana. And if you believe in the creation stories that have been told, passed down from the beginning of time across cultures, those stories too tell us that we're all one family, that we're all from one place. And we will understand the lives around us, and we will understand our place within that family much better if we become receptive to the secrets that animals like octopus will show us if only we are humble enough to learn.
Secrets of the Octopus comes from the National Geographic Society, the author, Cy Montgomery. Cy Montgomery, congratulations on yet another beautiful book.
Greg, such a joy to talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're turning to the Morning Show archives for an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. I promise that today's Morning Show will indeed be delicious because I have the great pleasure of speaking for the next few minutes with one of the world's most admired and renowned chefs, Eric Ripert. And perhaps you have seen his cookbooks, enjoyed his wise words on various television programs. Certainly, I'm sure many of you know the name. And he is associated with one of the premier restaurants in all of the world, chef and part owner of Le Bernardin in New York City. And you've perhaps seen him on Top Chef and other programs on television. His latest book is called Avec Eric, and that is French for With Eric, a culinary journey with Eric Ripert, in which he not only shares some favorite recipes, but takes us to various places where we can better understand the beauty of food and what the culinary sciences are all about. He is also responsible for a book I just love called On the Line, The Stations, the Heat, the Cooks, the Costs, the Chaos, and the Triumphs Inside the World of Le Bernardin, which is his wonderful restaurant in New York City. But we will primarily talk about this most recent book, Avec Eric. And this book is published by Wiley. Eric Ripert, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
I am excited about this very, very much. I love the definition which you give at one point about cuisine. You say at its heart, it is about flavor. The act of recognizing the attributes of a specific ingredient and understanding the way it will blend or contrast with other ingredients. It sounds simple in some respects, and yet this is, of course, a fairly complex matter. How have you come to be such a master at doing this, at recognizing flavors and understanding how best to put them together?
Well, I was very lucky that at a very young age I could be with my grandmother's aunts and mother. And one of my grandmother was from Provence, the other one was Italian. My mom was cooking very modern cuisine. So in between soul food and modern and hanging in those kitchens at a very young age, I developed definitely a palate. I was around five, and they were kind enough to let me believe that I was helping them in the kitchen, although I was eating everything they were doing. And being a bad student at age 15, I had to go to work in kitchen, and I developed love for cooking. And then later on, I really find my style, and my style is of cooking is to celebrate the quality of the ingredients. And for instance, at Le Bernardin, which is a seafood restaurant, we pay homage to the fish, and therefore the fish is the star of the plate, and whatever we put in a plate is to elevate the qualities of the fish. And I think you can do that with everything. If you buy a chicken, you should be thinking, how can I make the best chicken ever, and not thinking about, oh, I'm going to do a nice presentation, and or I'm going to do something, and then looking for what goes with it. You know, cooking for something is much stronger in terms of statement and results than cooking with something. Mm. So that was definitely the influence of cooking. And it's translated into our book, Avec Eric, which is our companion book of the PBS series that we have, Avec Eric. In the show and in the book, we start in the kitchen of Le Bernardin, so it's a little bit of a back of the house visit, and then I travel for inspiration, and I am interacting with farmers and growers and fishermen and winemakers, etc. And then I come back to my own kitchen, and I cook something inspired by my my trips and visits, and the recipes are easy to make, and they are definitely created for the home cook.
Very good. One of the things you help us understand is some of the challenges that are involved in putting together a recipe. And you tell us that one can go about this in different ways in terms of trying to create a brand new dish. You might start with a dish that already exists and just try to tweak it a little bit, or one might just start absolutely from scratch with no sort of starting point except, you know, just your own, the empty slate and your own imagination. You tell us that there are pitfalls involved in both of those sort of practices. How do you typically go about creating a new dish, and in particular, fashioning the recipe for that dish?
Well, again, driven by, I mean, the inspiration is driven by many things. One is the season. The season has a tremendous impact on creativity. The second thing is the ingredients and the surrounding. If you are in the Caribbean, or if you are in Canada in the winter, your inspiration is going to be very different, and I think and your creativity as well. I recommend for beginners to follow recipes all the time, because especially on a book like ours, Avec Eric, where we have tested the recipes very carefully to make sure that everyone has a good result, even if you are very, very a beginner. And then for the confirmed cooks, the book has so many images and pictures and so on. If you are very comfortable in your kitchen, you can definitely use some ingredients or use one picture or part of a recipe to create your own interpretation of what we have done. And that is what professional chefs do. You look at ingredients, you look at cookbooks, you travel, and then you come back, and because you have the basics of cooking, you are able to create. And it's actually a very pleasureful experience.
We are speaking with one of the world's most renowned chefs, Eric Ripert, talking about his book Avec Eric, which is a companion to the second season of the PBS television series in which Eric Ripert leaves New York City to visit beautiful places with beautiful food and particularly beautiful ingredients, and then returns to his own kitchen newly inspired. In fact, one of the things, Chef Ripert, that you say in your book is that when one lives in a big city, even a wonderful big city like New York City, it is easy to be disconnected from food sources. I suppose in any urban setting, it's very easy for that to happen. And in a sense, I suppose this experience that you write about and live out in this television series, it's sort of a way for you to combat that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, being in a city like New York, when you go shopping, very often you go to the store and everything is in a package. And or sometimes, you know, I mean, fruits and vegetables are definitely not in boxes, but you don't think about where is it coming from. And it's very important to make those trips to the country and to go visit the people who are at the source and who are passionate about cultivating the land and about growing animals. And it's, I think, essential to be inspired. And for me, it's very often I do that to understand again and have a different respect for the animals and for the vegetables, which are the gift of you know, the bounty that Earth is for us. So I think it's very important. And for instance, right now in the it's the season for apples picking, for the pumpkin, and if you can get out of the city and go to the fields and experience that, I think you come back very refreshed and inspired.
One of the visits you talk about in your book is to a couple by the last name of Sandberg, I believe, who own not only a superb restaurant, but also a wonderful farm. And, of course, it's complicated enough to own and operate a restaurant. Put on top of that, to own and operate a farm, it's almost unimaginable. And yet they have made this decision gladly, and you seem impressed by what they have managed to accomplish.
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, it's more and more chefs and restaurateurs who are not living in urban centers are trying to really cultivate the vegetables that they want in their restaurants, or even raise animals, because they want to have the freshest ingredients. And you know, they go to the garden, and an hour later, it's in a plate of the client. And it's a very, very different experience than buying, for instance, vegetables a few days later. A salad coming out of the soil has an incredible delicacy that over the time kind of disappear. And we see a new generation of young chefs that are very inspired to and they like the challenge of not only running the kitchen and the restaurant, but of running a garden. And it's difficult, but a lot of them are succeeding, and they get a tremendous pleasure in doing both, cultivating and taking care of the land, and at the same time cooking in their restaurant. Mm.
One of the things I loved about this book was the chapter called Teamwork, and it reminded me of your earlier book, On the Line, which goes into even more detail in terms of the complex team that is involved in a wonderful restaurant like Le Bernardin. And in this new book, you liken that team in a first-class restaurant to bees, of all things, honeybees. And you were inspired as you visited some beekeepers at a place called the Melissa Garden out in Sonoma County, California. Tell us how your restaurant resembles a literal beehive of activity.
Well, the restaurant has 140 employees working at the same time. And we have, you know, different aspects in a restaurant in terms of work. We have the reservation office, so we have people taking calls, and we receive up to 1,000 calls a day. And then we have the accounting office, and we have the management office, and then you have the kitchen with 40 cooks working together. You have the waiters with about 40 or 50 waiters, and you have the dishwashers, and everybody has to work in a kind of a limited space, and you have to be extremely efficient. And the goal is to serve clients and to make them happy and to have a great experience. And for that to happen, you have to not only work as a team, as one, but you have to have also a great organization, a lot of solidarity, because it's very often difficult. And I will give you an example. For instance, when you have 50 people eating at the same time and ordering different dishes, you have to have the client has expectations. What they want is the right dish that they ordered to be delicious on the front of them in a timely manner, in a clean plate. And to achieve that for 50 people at the same time or 80 people at the same time, we really work like bees. We work with a great organization, great passion, and we work, again, as a team.
And again, I think for so many of us who have only the vaguest notion of what is involved in making that happen, we learn so much from your books. One chapter in this new book, Avec Eric, is called Craftsmanship. And I so appreciate the way in which you help us to appreciate, for instance, the good work of one of your lead butchers at Le Bernardin, Justo Thomas. Tell us what he does on a daily basis and the ways in which he does it exceptionally well.
Yes. Well, Justo is someone that is a rare individual. He's our fish butcher, and he's basically responsible for receiving the seafood that comes to the restaurant every day. And then he's in charge of breaking down the fish and portioning the fish for the restaurant. And Le Bernardin, being a very successful fish restaurant, we receive about a ton of fish every day. And in a very quick matter, he's able to scale the fish, fillet the fish, portion the fish, take the bones out of the fish, because obviously we don't want any client to have bones in their mouth when they eat a fillet of fish. And he's someone who's extremely organized, extremely clean, very fast, very precise, and he's a master at his craft. Really, he's an inspiration for the entire team.
Hmm. I want to just read a moment of what you describe about how he does this. You say, Justo enjoys his job and is a true master craftsman. I have never seen anyone work faster than him at this task. He works very quickly but precisely, leaving no wasted product. When he goes on vacation, it takes three people twice as long to do what he accomplishes by 2 p.m. each day. Justo has a lot of respect for the fish, too, and it is always impressive to watch him work. I think that's so intriguing, the idea of having respect for, in this case, the fish which you are butchering.
Well, you know, we really think that anything that comes to the restaurant has been alive, and we respect the life, especially of animals. very much. And the last thing we want to do is to sabotage a beautiful ingredient. And we pay our respect by cooking it properly or making sure that we come up with a recipe that really is, again, an homage to that product. So we educate our staff to have that respect for every ingredient.
I'm reminded of something that you talk about in your previous book, On the Line, something that you learned from a chef by the name of Jean-Louis Paladin, who was at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. You tell us that one of his beliefs was that if a product is beautiful, you don't have to do very much to it. You just enhance its qualities. And I suppose much of what you are showing us in this book and this television series is kind of about that, about taking something that is already wonderful and, in a sense, not getting in the way of it, but just enhancing what is already a beautiful piece of fish or a beautiful vegetable from the garden. That's an interesting attitude that probably all good chefs need to take.
Well, I think it makes total sense. Since we are at Le Bernardin, let's say we take a piece of fish, and fish is very subtle in terms of flavor, and it's very delicate. The flesh of the fish is also very fragile. And if you cook a piece of fish that has such a great quality, and you add a lot of vegetables and a lot of spices, and you cook it in a very difficult and complicated way, at the end, you may have a dish that may taste pretty good, but you have lost the fish in it. And at Le Bernardin, our mantra is, the fish is the star of the plate. Therefore, whatever we do is to elevate the qualities of the fish. And you can apply that philosophy for every ingredient. If you cook a chicken or if you cook a piece of meat or anything, you have to. If you think like that, it will definitely be a powerful way of cooking, a delicious way of cooking. And at the same time, a very simple way of, it looks simple, but it's a lot of thoughts behind. But it will definitely inspire you to cook in a simple way.
We're speaking with Chef Eric Ripert, talking about his book Avec Eric, which is a companion book to his PBS series of the same name, which is now in its second season. Chef Ripert, you spend some time in chapter 7 of your book talking about artisans, which make impeccable products in small batches. And of course, we know about artisan breads and artisan cheeses. I'm especially interested to ask you about cheese, since our radio station is located in Wisconsin, one of the places in the world where one thinks immediately of cheese. Just say a word or two about some of the wonderful things that can be done when great care is taken in creating cheese.
Well, you can. Again, if you do it in an artisanal way, it's going to be a very different result than in an industrial way. And I have always been a great supporter of people who are doing things by hand, using machinery sometimes, but something that where a human being has a control and can put his input into it. And I think when you create cheese, you can be a master at creating incredible textures and flavors. And in our book, Avec Eric, we visit a cheese. Small cheese factory where the gentleman was hands-on and he was controlling every step. And at the end of the day, his cheese was very unique in terms of flavors. It's something that you wouldn't be able to find anywhere else. And therefore, people were traveling from afar to get his ricotta and to get any kind of cheese that he was doing, because it was something very, very personal about it. It was something that you can't really explain, but we all knew it was his creation. It was not none of the cheese was exactly the same, but they had this incredible flavor that industrial cheese doesn't have. And it was, again, for myself, a great experience and inspiration to be witnessing someone doing something like that.
I especially enjoyed the chapter called Oil and Wine, in which you tell us that a couple of different times a year at Le Bernardin, all of the chefs gather together for an oil tasting. And yes, my word, as you describe what this is like, it sounds so intricate and time-consuming, and obviously it is something you believe is of tremendous importance. Describe to our listeners the typical oil tasting at your restaurant.
For sure. So we're talking here about extra virgin olive oil, and what we do a couple of times a year, we take maybe 12 different brands at a time, and they are artisanal olive oils. And we do a blind testing. So we test the olive oil, and in between each testing, we clean our palate with some bread and a little bit of water. And we decide which one is the one that is going to be the best for what we are trying to do. For instance, if it's a fish raw, like carpaccio, and is marinated with extra virgin olive oil, what we look for is a little bit of acidity, a floral flavors coming out of the oil. We don't want bitterness. We don't necessarily need the peppery taste that kind of irritates the back of the throat. We are looking for something that is very, like I said, floral and soft and slightly acidic and very elegant. And olive oil is like wine. Depending of the year and depending of the weather, the quality change, and therefore you cannot rely on one brand forever. You have to do that exercise, and very often we have one name of olive oil for 6 months, and then we switch to another name, and then we go back to the same. But it's an exercise that I think is very important.
Along with all of the wonderful recipes in this book, and again, you've said that these are recipes intended not for the chefs of Le Bernardin as much as for the rest of us who might just be in our own kitchens. You make brief mention at the end of the book of some of your thoughts on designing kitchens and some of your thoughts on what the kitchen in the home ideally should be. Say a word about that, please.
Well, I think that, first of all, the kitchen should be a place where where the family, and if you entertain friends, can interact with the person who's cooking, and it should be basically the heart of the house. And a kitchen is something that should be very efficient. It's not about a decorative piece in your house or in your apartment. And I see a lot of kitchen in friends' house and when I visit people, which are beautiful to look at, but absolutely dysfunctional in terms of using it. And I think it's important when you design your kitchen to think about how are you going to entertain or cook for the family or have friends, and be part of the experience. And I see a lot of kitchen where the stove is against the wall. Therefore, when you're cooking, you are turning your back on your guests. So I recommend to have kind of an open kitchen where you can have a flat top or a stove that is on the front of you and on the front of the guest. And then you can drink and you can eat and you can interact. Also, I think it's very important to look at the distance in between the sink and the flat top, in between where the garbage can is going to be, where you storage your knife, where you have your pots and pans, and everything should be designed to make it a very efficient machine, because that will help you to be less stressed. It will allow you to produce a lot of food in a very timely manner and in a very easy way. The ingredients that you use the most should be close to you. The ingredients that you don't use very often should be storage somewhere else in a kitchen, and so on. So I pay attention to those details, and actually I just finished my kitchen, and I work with a company called Pog & Paul, which is a cabinetry designer, and we created what we believe is the ideal kitchen, where I have the stove facing the guest, I have the fridge right behind me, so I don't have to run to get ingredients in the fridge. I have my knife on the right side because I'm right hand, the garbage can underneath, and so on. So that's my idea of what we should be doing with kitchen.
Sounds wonderful. We are almost out of time, but I do need to mention one other thing. I especially appreciated at the beginning of the book, in the chapter Big Flavor, as you are talking about your sauce chef at Le Bernardin, you liken his good work to that of a great musician and the importance of both technique and instinct in a wonderful musical performance, that's part of doing wonderful things in the kitchen.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, the saucier is a very prestigious title in a kitchen. Then you become sous chef or chef, but this is a chef, sous chef, or manager. Saucier is the most educated cook of the kitchen, and is the one who's finally using his instinct to create flavors. And it's, until then, it's craftsmanship. And then when you become a saucier, it's about artistry, because flavors are something that you cannot measure in inches or in ounces or in pounds. It's all in the mind, and flavors are very fragile, and they kind of sometimes disappear very quickly, sometimes they expand. And to be able to control flavors and to create beautiful sauce, you have to be a great craftsman, but also be a true artist.
Hmm. The book and its series on PBS, both called Avec Eric, this book published by Wiley, the series on PBS, and responsible for both, the very talented, gifted, skilled chef Eric Ripert. Eric Ripert, I have thoroughly enjoyed this opportunity to meet you and speak with you. Thank you so much, and very best wishes to you.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you so much. Best wishes to you, too.